folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and today we're revisiting a story by Christine Gentry that she told on Risk back in 2016. It's one of our all-time favorites. In fact, it's a story that I teach in my online storytelling workshops. I do an analysis of it for the class. And today, we're revisiting the story together. Christine Gentry and I will, in 2025, be talking about how we feel about making the chain now. So, a quick break. And when we come back, Christine Gentry and I will revisit and review making the chain.
About cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a meta cheese melt, and it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese!
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
So it's 2012, and I'm scrolling through Facebook, and in between, you know, cat videos and Foursquare check-ins, because it's 2012, I see a post from an old friend of mine. Actually, I hadn't seen her in years. We were really close my first year of teaching, and the post was, "I'm dying." It was like, "I'm dying, my kidneys are completely giving up on me. All of my friends and family have already tried to donate a kidney to me, and this is my last resort. So Facebook, is somebody willing to donate a kidney to me?" And I dropped everything and sent her a message. I was like, "I am so sorry, I didn't even know you were sick. We haven't spoken in a while, but like absolutely, you know, what do I need to do?" And thus began this really intense series of tests. So I don't know if you guys know, but it's incredibly difficult to be approved to donate a kidney, which is why all of her friends and family had been rejected. So they run every test you can possibly run on a human being, including a pretty intense psychological exam. And if they find one thing wrong with you, they say no. But I was very lucky, and I got approved to donate. But Julia and I, as a couple, were not as lucky because I could not directly give my kidney to her. We were not a direct match. So it's way more complicated than I have time to explain to you. But like, you have to be blood type, tissue type, antigen, and a bunch of other stuff, right? So I couldn't directly give my kidney to Julia. But we were approved to go into this really cool system called the National Kidney Swap Registry. So it's this algorithm, this amazing computer that tries to take all of the incompatible donor recipient pairs across the country and figure out if I can give my kidney to some random person in the country that I'm a match to, and then further down this swap chain, Julia will get one, right? So we go into the system and the computer gets to work and it's trying to figure out how to make a chain. And at the very last minute, Julia directly matches with someone else and my kidney is not needed. Guys, it was amazing to watch the transformation of my friend Julia, right? She was not being hyperbolic on Facebook, right? She was attached to dialysis, which is basically the machine from Princess Bride, you know? Like, she was going home every day and hooking herself up and being like, "Please don't go to 50. Like, that was her day. And this one surgery, just every time I saw her, she was like a new and happier person. And then last year, she got pregnant. She had a baby. And I was looking at this child, and I was like, oh my God, like, this new life and every life that will be touched by it only exists because someone was willing to donate their kidney, and I just couldn't justify not doing it for a stranger. So I called the same organization and I said, this time I want to donate my kidney to anyone. I want to be what you guys call a good Samaritan donor. And it had been long enough to where they made me go through all the testing again. But again, I was very lucky. I got approved and this time it moved very quickly. I mean, within 2 weeks of my testing, the surgery date was set and the computer was loving it because this time I didn't go in with any conditions, right? Last time I went in with a very complicated condition, which was Julia, right? Julia has to receive one. And this time I'm like, I'll give it to anybody. Kidney for you. Kidney for you. And the computer was like, awesome. And it got to work. And it figured out the longest possible chain, right? It was like, oh my God, she can give her kidney to this person who's been waiting. And their incompatible donor can give their kidney to this person. And their incompatible donor can give their kidney to this person. And so when the surgery date was set, there was already a chain of 16 surgeries that my donation was going to set off, right? So I was going to pull 8 people off of that monstrous, horrible wait list. Like, what an honor. And I struggled with how to kind of deal with the celerity. It was moving so quickly. And I thought, you know, like, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't want people to think that this is really weird, that I'm some kind of like hero or saint. So I chose to keep it very private. And I told very few people. But I did have to choose a caretaker. So I definitely had to ask someone to take care of me. You can't do anything, basically, for the first week. And my mother is a nurse. Seems pretty obvious that you would ask your mom, the nurse. But it was a very complicated decision for me because my relationship with my mother the last couple years has been very strained. She was this glowing, like beautiful presence when I was a child, and this drinking problem had entered into her life and just sucked her into this really horrible place. Like physically she was unwell. She looked 20 years older than she should have looked. She was getting like slurring drunk like every night, and with it came this horrible cloud of negativity. I remember she came to visit me when I was living in New York. It was basically like a jump from alcoholic serving establishment to alcoholic serving establishment. And if they were more than 2 blocks away from each other, she would complain. And we would go down into the subway and she would turn her tiny engagement ring around and say, I hear that they take your jewelry on the subway. And I was like, who are you? Who are you? You don't even resemble the mother that I knew when I was a child. And so, like, when I had to choose this caretaker, I was thinking, like, first of all, there's a very real risk that this woman can't stay sober, honestly, for a week to take care of me. And also, like, that kind of negativity is not something I need around me when I'm going through this major recovery. And so I wrestled with it for a couple of days, but then I finally decided to ask her. So I invited her to come up, and she could only take exactly, you know, X number of days off. So she was going to come in the night before my surgery. And as the surgery approached, I was just, I was getting like overcome with this level of like fear and anxiety that I'd never known before and didn't really know how to deal with. Like the most extreme medical thing I'd ever been through was having my wisdom teeth removed, you know? Like, I had no idea what to expect. I had read all the things, but I had no idea what to expect as far as the actual experience. And I remember the Friday before this surgery came, like, it was now less than a week away, and I almost, like, I think I was having a panic attack. I don't know. My palms were sweaty. I was very lightheaded. I was so afraid. I couldn't stop focusing, like, laser focus on all of the things that I'd read, you know? Like, what if I die on this operating table? What if I get an infection? What if my kidney dies on the runway trying to get to this person that I'm trying to help? What if one day my other kidney fails? What if someone I really love needs one and I've already given it up to, like, Joe Schmo, you know? Like, all of these thoughts just were swirling around and I had no one to share them with or talk to, so I was, like, kind of a mess, and I started frantically cleaning my apartment, and I found this bag of clothes that I had shoved into the corner probably years ago that needed to be like tailored and repaired, and I was like, perfect, perfect distraction. So I go on Yelp, and I'm like searching for the closest tailor, and sure enough, there was someone who worked right out of her apartment, literally down the street from mine, and her name was Brunhilde. And I was like, yes. that Brunhilde, that's exactly what I need. And I give her a call, and of course she's available. The thick German accent when she answers the phone. I was like, this is perfect. This is meant to be. And so I start walking down the street to Brunhilde's apartment, and it's February, it's Boston, it's snowing, I'm crying, it's all very emo. And I have my bag of clothes, and I get to Brunhilde's apartment, and she opens the door, and she looks exactly the way that you think she looks. Like, giant German woman, huge boobs. And I walk in, and I open the bag of clothes, and I start pulling them out to kind of explain to her the things that I needed done to them. And she cuts me off. She says, "Honey, what's wrong?" And my bottom lip starts quivering, and I said, "Oh, Brunhilde, I'm donating a kidney on Thursday, and I'm so scared." And she just grabs me. She gives me this big old hug. She, like, sinks my head in the middle of her big boobs. She's, like, pawing my back. She goes, "Honey, you are doing a wonderful thing. You must remember to be one with the pain." It was just this, like, it was this beautiful moment of this absolute stranger giving me exactly the thing that I so needed in that moment. And so when I was walking home from Brunhilde's house, I was like, I have to tell people about this. I have to. I mean, first of all, the only reason I even know that it's an option is because someone posted on Facebook. But also, like, I'm not okay. I'm not okay right now. And I need to own that, and I need to reach out to my support network. And of course, like, as soon as I posted about it, there's this outpouring of love and support. It just so bolstered me. And, like, Brunhilde and I decided that I would pick up my clothes the night before the surgery on purpose. And so I go to her apartment, you know, the night before, and she opens the door, and this time she goes, "Honey, you look good. Last week, not so good. Now you look good." And my mom flew in, you know, after I picked up my clothes, and I immediately got worried because the first thing she wanted to do was go get a burger and a couple beers. And I was like, oh God. And I, like, kept my worry to myself. I was like, maybe it's just night before jitters. Maybe she just got to get that, you know, last beer out of her system. And we came home from the restaurant, and we sat down on my bed, and our knees were touching. And she held my hands across our laps. And I'm not even a religious person, but she said this prayer over me. She was basically just asking God to protect me, and I just felt it. I just felt this sense of peace. And I told her about how nervous and scared that I had been, and, like, how I think it's difficult for anonymous donors because, you know, in 2012, it was so easy. Anytime I started to get afraid about this possibility, I would just look at Julia. I'd be like, oh, obviously, like, look at this person that I care about, like, suffering. And this time, you know, there's no palpable thing. There's no person to look at. I'm, like, sending my kidney out to the ether, you know, like, or in my case, Ohio. And it's hard, you know. So I was, like, telling her, I was crying, I was explaining, you know, the panic attack and Brunhilde and how amazing she is. And my mom helped me come up. She was like, "You need to give these people faces. You know, these eight people, these eight recipients that you're pulling off of the wait list, like, you need to imagine what they look like." And so we came up together with this haven. You know, it was based on this plaza in Barcelona that I just stumbled upon, and just, it was so beautiful. Like, I turned the corner and it opened up into this plaza with an old church, and there was this big tree, and it was, like, raining orange flowers, and there was this little turquoise water fountain bubbling in the middle of it, and I was the only person there, and it was just the sound of my heart and, like, classical guitar bouncing off of the labyrinth of the Gothic quarter. You know, it was just this magical place. And so we decided that was going to be my haven, and whenever I got scared, I would close my eyes and turn the corner, and I would be in that plaza, and I put the eight people at that fountain. And every time I got scared, I would just think about turning the corner and seeing those eight and being like, right, this is why I'm doing it. And I rolled into that operating room the next day, having never been more sure of anything in my life. Such a sense of calm and peace had come over me. But I am not here to lie to you, and the first few days of recovery were awful. They were so hard, and my mother got the crap shift. She did, and she did not leave my side. She slept in the hospital room with me. She didn't have a drop of alcohol or utter one complaint for 5 days. And the third day that I was in the hospital, they took me off of the Dilaudid IV drip, and they tried to replace it with an oral version of the pill, and my stomach was not taking it. And you guys, like, nausea is just a terrible feeling regardless. Like, you all know it. It's awful. It's objectively a terrible feeling. But when nausea is bathed in terror because you've just had major surgery and you have this giant abdominal incision and you know that if you puke, it's going to hurt so badly. Like, that was the feeling that I had. And my mother was comforting me. And then I puked. Valentine's Day. It was Valentine's Day, day three. And I was incapacitated. And so I just puked all over myself. And so there was like the embarrassment, and I'm crying, and the pain, guys, the pain, it was like every time I heaved, it was like a blacksmith had taken a newly forged spear and shoved it into my side. And my mother took this warm washcloth and she was wiping my face. And I grabbed the bars of that hospital bed crying, and I said, I don't want to regret this, Mama. I really don't want to regret this. She was wiping my face saying, you won't, Christine, it'll get so much better. And the nurse came in and she was like, oh, we should probably try a different pill. And I grabbed her scrubs and I was like, you will never put another prescription pain medicine in my mouth. And she goes, it's really early. And I was like, I don't care. So that's how on day three of my surgery, I started recovery on just over-the-counter Tylenol. And it was my mother who pushed me to get out of bed every day, even though it hurt so badly. She said, you can walk a little further this time. I saw you touch the edge of that windowsill yesterday. I bet you can make it to the other side of that window today. And when they finally took my catheter out and I was so excited about taking a shower and then got so crushed because I couldn't do it myself, it was my mom who took me and led me from the bed, and she walked me to the shower, and she put the seat down in it, and she took my clothes off, and she sat me down in the shower, and then she took her clothes off, and she stepped into the shower, and she closed the curtain, and she bathed me so gently, and we were both crying, and she said, Christine, it's just like when you were a baby. I went home on day four, and my mom and my best friend took care of me for another 6 days, and my friends brought me more food than I can even eat, and my students made me homemade cards. And then I got a call from the National Kidney Registry about a month ago, and they said, Christine, the chain that you started is still going. It's 56 surgeries long. Your one decision has pulled 28 people off of the wait list. What an honor. That's more people than could ever fit around that fountain. And they said, we want you to come to our gala. It's the longest chain we've had in years. We want you to speak. And I said, absolutely, as long as I can bring my mom. Thank you.
How are you? You said you've had quite a day.
I've had a day. It is so nice to see you, though. It's so nice to revisit. It was like a whole experience re-listening to it because it's been a while.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always been like an all-time classic on the show. And one of the things that strikes me every time is that we feel all the emotions in this story, you know?
Yeah. That's true. I take you all over the map.
And one of the things I so appreciate about you as a storyteller is that you exude that. You know, you're true to the funniness, the fear, the sadness. Like, we hear it in your voice. You're there.
Aw, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really understand. I know some people are able to do it, but I don't understand when people are able to tell it and be detached. For me, every time I tell a story, I'm very much living it again. And so go on the journey with you in a way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the most common way that that sometimes happens, that a person is detached, if there's some, you know, real PTSD that hasn't been, you know, processed enough. Yeah. So it was told in 2016.
That's right.
And so much has happened. Well, so much has happened.
In the world. Both of my kidneys have had so many adventures since 2016.
That's true. Oh my God. Yeah. So how did it feel to listen back to it again?
There was a lot that I had forgotten that I had said, which was fun. I had listened to it a few times, of course, over the years, but it's definitely been at least 2 years since I had listened to it. And I was watching it too, right? So like watching yourself on video is always kind of funny. But I think what struck me is just how fresh it was in the moment, because I told it a matter of months after. It was very fresh. I mean, we'd have to look back at the date of the show, but I think it was March or April. I donated February 11th.
Damn.
So it was, you know, like I was still healing technically when I was on stage.
I don't think I realized that.
Yeah. So the emotions were very new. But it's funny because I don't think that the emotions have really faded that much, because I've very much felt them all rewatching the story. Especially the stuff with in the hospital. Like that was like very very fresh. It doesn't matter how many years it's been. Those are such vivid memories for me.
Yeah. I do think that even though there's that famous maxim, tell stories from your scars, not your wounds, I do think that if a person has some experience with storytelling or creative writing, you know, some familiarity and comfort with the form, that actually it's often big old home runs if it's really fresh and you're still feeling it. Yeah.
Yeah. But also then the news that comes at the end of the story, the news that my chain had kept going. And I think at the time my story was maybe even still going. We'd have to look back at the date, but that was like the freshest emotion because it was the newest news. And it was so nice to be able to have that kind of be the end of the story, that this whole experience I had gone through was for what I thought was 16 surgeries, right? And it ended up being so much bigger than that. As you said, like so much has happened since, including being able to meet several people in my chain, including my direct recipient, which was a total honor. And also the way the chain worked is like me at the top, you know, I didn't have anyone connected to me, right? And then each of the incompatible donor recipient pairs came together. And then at the end, the final donor, there was kind of a hanging kidney, right? Because there was nowhere for that kidney to go because I had been alone. So the way the National Kidney Registry works is that kidney is owed to the hospital that I had donated at.
Oh.
So the first person that I met was actually that person.
Holy cow.
Because she was in Boston because she was at the hospital that I had donated at. And she was actually on the deceased donor waiting list. So if you know anything about kidney donations, like the deceased donor waiting list is still, of course, better than nothing. But there's a big difference between getting a cadaver kidney and a living one.
Oh, my God.
Right. There's a really big difference in quality. So no one in her family, none of her family and friends were able to donate to her or to get into the National Kidney Registry for her. So she was waiting for a deceased kidney donor. And she got a call. She was actually at her son's grave. And she got a call from the hospital that said, not only do we have a kidney for you, but it's a living kidney.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Her name's Henrietta. She's a total dream.
Oh, my God.
She told me later that it was like winning the lottery, but you didn't know you'd bought a ticket.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Wow. And did you say you also met two others?
I have met multiple people. I would have to go back and look at exactly how many, but I've met. So the way the chain works, like everyone has to kind of agree to lift the anonymity. It's like a double blind situation.
I see.
You know, we're all like codes in the chain. And then if you are interested in having contact with anyone else in the chain, you have to tell your hospital. They have to tell the other hospitals. And so we found each other. Like I met a couple in the chain in San Diego, and then the hospital in Boston actually hosted like a whole meetup at one point.
Oh my God.
Several people in the chain flew in to Boston for that, which was really cool. I got to meet the surgeon who, you know, put his hands inside of me and pulled the kidney out.
Amazing.
I was like, nice to meet you, like, awake.
What a trip.
Yeah, so it was really cool because everybody, of course, has their own individual story of going through kidney failure and trying to find a kidney, finding somebody who was willing to donate but not able to give directly, entering into the registry, getting the call, right? They all got the call because all of the surgeries happened within a few days.
Oh my gosh, that's outrageous. Of course.
There's so many planes involved in getting kidneys out of people and into new people.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. FedEx Express.
It's really cool the way it works.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that I thought when rehearing it is, we're living in this time when there's a lot of, oh my God, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
How can I be of service? How can I help? Or what difference could I possibly make?
Mm.
I'm not saying everyone should be donating a kidney necessarily.
Right. It's a big decision. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we really feel, especially from the part of the story where you're leading up to the surgery and having the surgery and then recovering from it, It's scary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to be honest about that. I don't think people should, you know, gloss over the hard parts.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because anyone who makes this decision should be fully informed about it.
Yeah. I was also thinking that any act of love, any act of, I'm going to do this because I think it'll help someone, there is some riskiness to it usually, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, it just feels like kind of sometimes you can take a big risk and go above and beyond in what you're doing in order to make a difference. And you have to just own that it might not be as happy an ending as your story is. But that's part of the beauty of it, too.
That's true. I mean, I've met several other donors just over the years, and each of them has their own story. And I actually know somebody who donated, who went through everything that I went through, and it was not a chain. It was a direct donation, and the kidney didn't survive.
Oh, wow.
You know, so that's another thing you have to be like emotionally ready for. I'm going to go through this and it might not work, right?
Absolutely.
I was donating February 11th in Boston. I was like, if it snows and this plane can't get off the ground.
Oh, my God.
Like, of course. My kidney might die on a runway.
Oh, my God. Wow.
So you really have to be ready for all of it. And it's like, no, it's no small miracle, right? All the surgeries all going well and all the transplants being successful and everyone healing okay. And to my knowledge, we have lost one person on the chain, but she was very, very sick and she got extra time because of this chain. And that's hard too, you know, but everyone should be fully informed if they do something like this. So yeah. I didn't want to shy away from the hard parts.
Yeah. It's also kind of unexpected. Well, of course, Brunhilde is unexpected in the story.
How fun is she?
She's so wonderful. But it's also unexpected in the story what happens between you and your mom.
Yeah. Yeah. I always tell people this story is not really about a kidney donation. At the heart of it, it's about my mom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the first half or so of the story, I was kind of assuming, oh, well, it's a good thing she met Brunhilde because mom's going to be checked
out. Mom's going to blow it. Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Yeah. And has your family, have members of your family heard the recording?
I don't think so. I don't think so. My family, they don't Google me. They should, because there's a whole bunch of stories about them. But I don't think they do. I mean, they've heard, I've told different versions over the years. Like there was one that was recorded for PBS that I think was, I think they heard that one. Mm-hmm. This one, I was, for understandable reasons, not really interested in directly sharing it. The honesty could be potentially a little painful, but of course, wouldn't mind if they did find it. Speaking of, so much has changed, right? My family has gone through a lot since this recording in 2016, including, you know, I've told stories with you about the dissolution of my parents' marriage after 40 years, which happened after this story and was related to the alcoholism in this story. And also my parents' healing of their relationship and rebooting as friends and, you know, ending up with other people. And my mother is sober right now. And
amazing.
Right. So there's like a lot of really good things that we've landed on. But that story was just one stepping stone and a long path when it comes to my relationship with my mom and her relationship with alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting thing. One of the things that I always kind of worry about when I'm telling a story is once you put words to something, you begin to question, okay, is that the absolute truth? Because is anything the absolute truth? And will I feel this way even tomorrow, mm-hmm. you know?
But you are capturing like a snapshot, right? And and what are we if not a collection of the stories that we tell ourselves and others? So, you know, who I was in 2016, I think, is very accurately captured by this story and what my relationship with my mother was like. And I love that the ending of the story is like a beautiful moment of connection for us and a moment where she showed up. And I was deeply worried she wouldn't. And that doesn't, you know, recovery and progress is not a straight linear line. Like, right. You know, it wasn't always that way since 2016, but she did right by me in this experience and really made it so much easier on me because it was hard. So
yeah,
it was nice for that to be a positive moment for us.
I would imagine that it was inspiring for her, you know, because I was thinking so many risk stories are about a person to whom something terrible happens or they fell down a rabbit hole and then found the wherewithal to transcend it. But it's a little rarer to hear a story where someone is just like, I'm going to do good and take a big risk in doing it, you know? There's something wonderful and unique about that. And I get the general impression in the story that your mom must have been rather touched.
I think so, for sure. I mean, my family was honest that they were a little worried about me doing this, you know, risky thing for a total stranger. But they were also supportive of my choice. And obviously, my mom helped me in my recovery. And an interesting, very recent little epilogue is that my phone rang when I was at the Harlem 125th train station. This was less than a week ago. And it was my aunt, my mother's sister. And I have not spoken to her in so long. I was like, oh my gosh, is something wrong? You know, like I answered the phone and she was like, hey, your mom told me to call you because a friend of mine has kidney disease and I'm thinking about maybe like helping her out. And she reminded me that you had donated. So I like talked on the phone with my aunt for like almost an hour about the National Kidney Registry and what donation involves and everything. I should have just sent her the story.
Amazing.
But yeah, so speaking of my mom, you know, being proud of what I've done and supportive and definitely telling other people.
That's extraordinary. Yeah, I love the fact that you did this and it's 2016 and there have been so many moments of things opening up or repercussions of it since then, you know, it continuing to kind of bubble up.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, I'm sure you remember this, like you met someone at Caveat, his name is Hendrik, who literally donated a kidney because he heard this story on Risk.
Yeah, totally,
right?
Totally.
And that's just someone we know about. There might have been others as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell a story on Risk. I told it long, long time ago about when I was 17 and I went down to Peru on a sort of a mission trip to build school buildings for children in the slums, you know, on the outskirts of a city. And I was asked by the Jesuits to come back and tell a story about it to all 1,300 of my fellow students at the high school that I went to. And I wasn't sure how I felt about it because I was like, oh, am I going to sound like I'm some sort of pious saint, you know?
Look at me. Look how amazing I am.
Yes. Yeah. But it really, really, really moved people. And then I found out that they copied the story. They sent it to all these Jesuit high schools around the Midwest, and that so many people had signed up to go on these mission trips inspired by my story. Yeah, so that was kind of, even though it didn't occur to me to get into this on stage sort of storytelling many, many years later, I think that was an initial moment of, oh, you can do something with this stuff.
Right, yeah. You and I can nerd out about this forever, but there's so many reasons to tell personal stories on stage. And, you know, this one obviously helped me navigate the experience myself and make sense of it and make sense of my choices and my relationship with my mother. But also it had like a meta purpose as well, right? Which is to make sure people know about this. I mean, God bless the National Kidney Registry, but I want to like hire a full-time PR person because people don't know.
Mm.
There's this vague idea. I know people understand like one can donate a kidney,
right,
but almost no one that I have told this story to already knew that it's possible to go into a system with someone you're not compatible with.
And the whole chain thing I was never aware of.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that these non-directed donors, as they call them, Good Samaritan donors, can start long chains of folks who are waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
That's incredible. Has your health been affected in the years since at all?
0%, Kevin. I completely forget that I only have one kidney the vast majority of the time. Like, it has not impacted my life at all.
That's incredible.
And in fact, the only time that I think about it is when I have a headache, because like every over-the-counter pain medicine except Tylenol passes through your kidneys. Mm. So if you only have one, you should take Tylenol instead of the others. So that's really the only time I think about it is if I don't have Tylenol and have to ask somebody if they do. that's the only time that I think about it. And so it's really true. So again, like the testing is annoying, but it is true that they do it to protect you. So they won't take your kidney unless your body is going to be not only okay, but just fine with just one.
Well, it is such a pleasure to revisit it. I am moved every time I hear it. I'm just like kind of taken aback to re-listen and be like, oh my gosh, I'm about to cry all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt that rewatching it as well, especially the Haven part. I got a little emotional when I remembered how helpful that was for me and that it had been my mom's idea.
Yeah. That is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, to come up with that place and give those people faces that I still see. After I told the story on my 1 year kidneyversary, I got a tattoo on my incision scar. It was designed by one of my students, and it's Braille. And it's the number symbol and the numbers 1 through 8. And it fits right over my incision scar. And some of those people, the first 8 recipients, I have now met.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I have now lost.
Mm.
And some of them I will never meet. It's really interesting to kind of, in my mind, replace some of those people around the fountain with real faces as I met real people. And then some of them just remained these faces I had created.
That is that. You can find Christine online at christinegentry.com. So let us know what you thought of Christine's stories or any of these stories we've been revisiting. And if you've got an old Risk favorite you'd like for us to revisit with the storyteller today, let us know. You can find us on all the socials at Risk Show. Or you can hit us up at the Risk Podcast Fans Discussion Group on Facebook or on Reddit at r/riskpodcast. Or you can just email me directly at kevin@risk-show.com. definitely email me if you're interested in my next online storytelling workshop that will start on January 14th. We will meet at what will be Wednesday evenings at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time. So whatever time zone you're in, figure that out. And one of the things that you have access to when you become a part of the workshop is over 7 hours of my lectures and story analyses and brainstorming activities on videos. And Christine's story, Making the Chain, is I do an analysis of it in the video content for the workshop. So email me at kevin@ristashow.com. If you think you might want to jump in on the one starting on January 14th, 2026. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. Oh. Sorry, I wasn't recording.
Oh my God.
I saw the stop button and I was like, I've stopped? Oh no, that's stop.